Hello, my friends. Hello, my life warriors, wherever you are in the world. Welcome to the Day In, Day Out podcast. Woo! Today on episode 212, I was very lucky to have Michael Stein on the podcast. He is an entrepreneur, actor, writer, director, producer, stand-up comedian, host of the Long Shot Leaders podcast, and business owner. Yeah, I have to say, this podcast today, my man here, he is quite an inspiration, to say the least. His life is somewhat like a screenplay. If he wasn't telling me it, I wouldn't believe it. But we talked about a number of things: how he got started as an entrepreneur, how he got into stand-up, how he got into the LA club scene, and how he did a short film as a Dirk Diggler, that very famous porn star from Boogie Nights. We talked about so many more other things as well. Got to say, really enjoyed this. So please sit back, enjoy the show. Don't forget to subscribe, and have a good one. Ha ha. Yes. Peace. Oh. Hello, my friends. Hello, my life warriors, wherever you are in the world. Welcome to the Day In, Day Out podcast. Woo! Today on episode 212, I am very privileged to have Michael Stein on the podcast. Now, look, he's a bit like the talented Mr. Ripley. He is a man of many skills, I have to say. He is an entrepreneur, actor, writer, director, producer, stand-up comedian, host of the Long Shot Leadership podcast, as well as many other things. I'm not going to go into his company. He can tell us about that in a moment. How are you today?
I'm doing great. I just love you. I love your energy. I just already off the bat, I just love this guy. I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. Look, I can't send out a check to you right now. I've got a number of rubber checks in circulation. God help me if anyone tries to cash it in. All I know is a black van will pull up for me one day and they'll just let me go, get in the van. But nevertheless, here we are today. Now, yes. I've got to say, my friend, you, sir, you can have a small feature film or series done about your life. you can't say it's really sort of started out slow. It's gone at somewhat of a pace, let's just say. Starting in LA, how on earth did you sort of get started in your, how can I say, wilderness, off-the-wall productions, say?
Well, I come from a wild off the wall family. So, you know, I'll tell you my little background story. You know, I do a podcast called Long Shot Leaders is because I'm a long shot. I come from a long line of long shots. My grandmother escaped the Russian concentration camps on the way to America. My dad was a New York homeless street kid, became a multimillionaire, only to become homeless again. I was born 2 months premature. I had all the ADHD, the ADD, the health issues. I was put in a special needs school for a little while at UCLA for an all school. And then I really had no success other than making people laugh at me or, you know, whatever. And then I, like most American kids, I saw the movie Rocky when I was 10 years old. And I was like, you know, here's a guy like me. He's not successful. He gets knocked down and keeps on getting back up. He's funny, but the only difference between this guy and myself is that he's physically fit. So I became physically fit every day since then. And I became a physical fitness when I was 16. And I said, oh, there's a second bit of success. And then I said, I'm gonna be an entrepreneur. And my tutor in high school said, you know, you should work with your hands because not everybody's meant to do what they want to do. Mm-hmm. So I said, you lady. And I started my business the day after high school and I failed miserably. And I waited 6 months and I studied at the city college. I didn't want to go to college, but I just studied there. And I said, I'm going to take acting, psychology, and business. And 6 months later, I decided to do stand-up comedy when I was 19. And I packed the house and I said, if I can get people here, I can get them to go to a nightclub. So then I started my nightclub called Off the Wall. And within 6 months, I became the number one nightclub promoter in Los Angeles. And my age bracket. And that's what started my acting career. I met my friend at the time, Paul Thomas Anderson, who did a short film called The Dirt Diggler Story. And he wanted me to play Dirt Diggler. So I played Dirt Diggler, which became Boogie Nights. And I appeared in that as well. And then I started writing, directing, and producing documentaries and films to segue out of my nightclub to get into the film business. Did underground gambling casinos. So I wrote a screenplay on underground gambling casinos. And then I wrote several other screenplays, and I did a short film, a drama, and won many awards, got live action short category, second pass of the Academy Awards, didn't make it, but I got bought by HBO, did really well. I got close to a movie deal with one of my screenplays, that gambling screenplay. And after 2 years of development hell and me burning the boats and leaving my nightclub business, I was broke after working as a production assistant and a starving filmmaker and actor. And I said, screw Hollywood. I'm going to make my own movie. But I was broke. So then I had to start a business and make the money. So I started a business. I made $500,000 within the first 6 months. I was able to then write, direct, produce, and act in a film called Love Hollywood Style with Faye Dunaway, Andy Dick, and Coolio, crazy cast. And found myself acting across from two-time Academy Award winning Faye Dunaway. And almost bottomed out my business trying to make that movie. And afterwards, I said, you know what? I'm going to choose opportunity over passion. I chose my business. I've grown that into a business made over $100 million since. And there's many other twists and turns and craziness in between there. But that's kind of like my story of why I do a podcast called Longshot Leaders, because the ebb and flow of failure and success seems natural to me. And that's why I'm on your show today, I guess.
Well, you know what, people? There you go. That's it in a nutshell. Goodbye. Have a good day. See ya. Oh, my. This is what I'm talking about. Yes. A film? No, maybe. Most probably a series. Look, because this is the thing. Look, okay, there are some places in the world which would be absolutely insane to have a club. Look, London, Paris, New York, L.A. is most probably the place on friggin' steroids when it comes to doing the whole club night lifestyle. Like, how did you went, okay, yeah, I'm a comedian, doing stand up, I can pack a place. How did you come about getting your club? Because that must have been must have been a challenge in itself.
Well, I was working out at Gold's Gym, and I had some friends that worked at the door at this one club. I was searching for a club. I just wanted to do a nightclub. It fit really well my personality. I'm super hyper. So then I was like, okay, these guys do this club. So they had an opening. It was the worst night. It was a Wednesday night, but it was, underage. So, summertime. And I said, I get the door, you get the bar. And basically I was able to grab the slowest night. And through there, just being 7 nights a week, 7 days a week, and hyper-focus, I was able to become that successful promoter, which led into doing one of the biggest movie premiere parties, not a premiere, premiere itself, but a promotional movie for the movie Batman in 1989. That was like the big blockbuster of the time. And 6 months before, I was up in Aspen because my girlfriend at the time, her dad was Peter Gruber, he produced Rain Man and Batman. He just won the Academy Award for it. And I didn't even know who they were when I started dating her, but serendipitously, so I'm a fish out of water. I grew up in a rich family or in a rich area and a poor family because my dad made all that money and he lost all the money. Yeah. I had to sleep in the same room with my grandmother until I was 9 years old. So I'd hear that story about how she escaped the Russian concentration camps. And then I'd wake up to hawking in the morning, which was my alarm clock. That's how I grew up, so I grew up as a poor family in a rich neighborhood. But when I met the Goobers, isn't that funny last name, Goober, but Peter Goober, Peter Goober is a big mogul in Hollywood. And I was up in Aspen and John Peters, who was Barbara Streisand's ex-husband, was out there, and Chris Peters, and I see each other, and he's a bloke that's kind of wearing a black leather jacket. I'm wearing a black leather jacket. We're both the black sheep of the area. And I look at him, he looks at me and goes, hey, what have you been up to? Because we kind of knew each other. And I said, I've been promoting nightclubs. I go, what have you been up to? He goes, well, I want to get into promoting nightclubs. As soon as he said that, I took the floor. We were at this big table up in Mezzaluna, up in Aspen. And I knew I'm in front of Peter Gruber, the most powerful man in Hollywood at the time. John Peters is his partner. And I said, I started talking about nightclubs. I started talking about the movie Batman that's coming out. I said, let's plan this big event at the biggest venue in Los Angeles. It holds 4,000 people. 6 months later, when the movie comes out, I do I can't, the biggest promotional, 4,000 people for the Batman movie at the Park Plaza Hotel. And that was just one of the things I did in nightclub promotion. And that's, you know, how I got to meet more people and get involved in film and things like that.
Yeah, and like that must have been absolutely nuts, because like this is the thing. One of the things I do for like a 9 to 5, because hey, this podcast is not paying me money. It's
just, I hear you.
And, like, as I'm, hey, where's your podcast check?
Right. Floats away.
Yeah. I do like sort of table sales for events at like basically business to business. And one of the things which always blows my mind is the operations team, what they have to go through just to make sure all the wheels are working, turning in the same direction. Like that logistic, it boggles my mind, because I think if I had to try keeping all of that together, it would drive me bonkers. How did you manage to like get the biggest Hollywood like premiere at the time? Because Batman 1989 was so epic. It was like it was the first time anything was that epic, I would say.
To me, it harkens back to the Mike Tyson line. He takes his disadvantages and making them advantages. So my disadvantage was having ADHD, but the advantage to having ADHD is you have hyper-focus. So I was so hyper-focused on what I was doing because I was really interested in that. And I took ownership of that, and I was proud to be that person. So when it came time to promoting nightclubs, it was all in, 7 nights a week, 7 days a week, running for president without the education, shaking hands. Organization, I'm a hyper-natural person, so I'm going from place to place and here and there and there, and I'm able to like juggle a lot of things without feeling the overpressure, because your mind's constantly spinning anyways. Now, organization on a mundane level is a different thing, but for the nightclub business, it doesn't get too sophisticated to where you have to work with Excel spreadsheets. So at that time, being 20 years old, you know, I was able to manage quite a bit through just sheer determination and hyperactiveness.
Yeah. I can only imagine that, going through all of that must have been like, okay, the doors must have opened onto some like new levels when like you go through that. It's like this, how can I put it? There are some things where you do in life where it's either closes a door or it opens it to that next level where you're like going, oh, I didn't know I could ascend so high. What was the sort of the next step after that? I need to know, because I'm curious. Hey.
So that's a great question, because, you know, every step the door is open. So when you do stand-up comedy, you're like, I didn't know I could do that, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I did nightclubs, and I didn't know I could do nightclubs at work. And then you do bigger and bigger, bigger events, and you're meeting more people. And then you become like a mini celebrity in LA as a nightclub promoter. So you get more opportunities, and I meet people, and whatever you're strong at, they like it. So like when I met Paul Thomas Anderson, he was a struggling filmmaker, but I made him laugh all night. So then he calls me up the next day and says he wants me to play this character in this short film called The Dirk Diggler Story. Or I meet other people and say, look, you know, you fly up in a private Learjet to Aspen and meet like the son of the John Peters. And he says, I want to do nightclubs, and I do nightclubs. And then I have something to offer, and I feel like I have value. So I don't feel like I'm taking anything from anybody, because that was a big thing for me, not to be one of those guys that takes, you know, but rather gives. And then I was able to do bigger events. So then you see other people around you also that are successful. And then you're like, I just did this, I just did that, I could do what they do too. So I did do that. I did burn my boat. So I left my nightclub business, and I decided to become a full-time production assistant working on commercials and just, you know, being a peon compared to being the mini celebrity star nightclub promoter. But I wanted to make films. So then I started doing documentaries. I did a documentary in the history of house music and rave scene in 1993. I toured the United States, and I interviewed the pioneers of house music, which is Stephen Silcurly and Jamie Principle, who created house music. And then it got sent over to England, became popular over there. And then it went back to Chicago. And then they finally said, oh yeah, it was like the Beatles.
Yeah,
and then I filmed all those guys, and then I created that documentary and just did documentaries for a while. And then I did that award-winning short film by putting yourself out there working as a production assistant. And then you get other people that you get to meet, more people in production, and they work on your film, and then you collaborate there. So just meeting people and putting yourself out there, those nightclub, it started with a nightclub business for me, because that's what really got me to really, I've always wanted to be connected to people, whether it's stand-up comedy or whatever, but nightclubs really fast tracks how many people you meet and who you get to know, especially in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I can only imagine. We're being sort of, how can I say, nightclub famous. You got a weird take on the sort of whole LA scene, because look, okay, because this is the thing. People like, oh yes, I want to be a movie star. And if they can't be a movie star, television. If they can't be television, like, yeah, like, it goes down to next rank. But like, this is the thing. When you're in the realm of like sort of nightclubs, that sort of entertainment side of things, it's kind of like, how can I say? It's akin to sort of like John Wick in some regards, because it's kind of like there's this world you've got here, but there's this other world which goes on. And if people are in the know, then they know. If they don't, they will never actually see this world. And I'm even talking about, yeah, major A-list stars to like, yeah. How did you kind of navigate that world? Because like, you might have had some people like who are big A-list stars, like, I know you. And you're like, that is weird. How do you know me? you know what I mean?
Yeah, so this is a very interesting subject also, because it's a very different kind of culture, Hollywood culture. And, you know, my journey with it was interesting because, for example, when I was promoting my first nightclub Off the Wall, it was 2 weeks before that, and I was working as an extra because I was still broke at this point, but I was just before I started the first night of my nightclub. And I was working on a film called Less Than Zero with Andrew McCarthy and Robert Downey Jr. And several other people. And I'm hanging out with this extra, good looking blonde guy. And I was on that shoot for 3 days. He was working on it for like 5 days, 2 days before me. And he showed me around. He goes, hey, you want to meet Robert Downey Jr.? Because he was an extra and I'm an extra. We're like peons. And I said, sure. Yeah. The guy from Weird Science. I want to meet him. Yeah. He's cool. So then Robert Downey Jr., really cool guy. Andrew McCarthy ripped up one of my invites. I didn't really appreciate him too much. So then after, Andrew McCarthy was a big 80s star. Yeah. But after a couple of the movies, I remember telling my friend, I was hanging out with this nice blonde guy, and we were actually in a scene together. If you see like extras, you see in the same movie that we walk along the same line together. That I was like, these poor guys come out for like the Midwest, you know, and like Missouri, and try to become actors and they don't make it. But it took me like 3 movies to figure out the guy that I was like best friends with on that shoot was Brad Pitt. And I was like, if he was a nightclub promoter, I would have been able to like, you know, become closer friends with him. But I mean, if he's a nightclub goer, but I remember, you know, inviting him, but he never showed up. But he went from an extra to his first big break in Thelma Louise and did well. And then you look at the ebb and flow of like happenstance of like, he's a really nice guy. Then you look at other people that, you know, say, well, he wasn't from there. That's unusual. Usually, you know, people that live there are well adjusted. I know other people that grew up in Los Angeles that are huge in the entertainment industry and they're just assholes, you know? So it's a bubble that can be predisposed towards having a certain type of mentality. That sucks. And it's also a really great avenue because, I mean, filmmaking and acting and arts and entertainment is a wonderful, you know, a business. It's creative. So there's a lot of dynamics to it. So to answer your question on what it's like, you know, in that industry and what it's like meeting these people, you know, they're just people like you and me. There's a lot of scarcity, like they're worried to lose it or worried to, you know, network a little bit. Sometimes you'll see a lot of that. So like, well, if I introduce you to this guy, then maybe that's going to lose the opportunity when I can work with him, you know? So there's a lot of that going on. And, but they're just people like you and me. There's no different. They're just somebody that time plus effort plus opportunity met, you know, a good circumstance. And now they are consistently working because they're able to do their job. And that's just all it is, just a job.
Yeah, I hear you. Because like, this is the thing, like, okay, just like, oh, you're a nice Midwestern guy. It's like, happens to be Brad Pitt. You're like, oh, wait. It reminds me of this. I watched, you remember the TV show Dallas?
Yeah.
Like they had a reunion episode and like you had like basically like you had like some of the guys from Dallas where like, because Brad Pitt was on an episode, he was like, that's getting right off with, like the sister or something like this. And I get like, and like, yeah, he gets beaten up and thrown out. And they're like both, like they're both standing there. Like, I'm, yeah, I have no idea what happened to that Brad Pitt guy. It was just like, laughter ensued. But
you want to hear something really funny about stardom and people that were before they were famous and then become famous. So Brad Pitt was nominated for best actor for, he didn't win, but for Curious Case of Benjamin Buttons. Oh, yeah. And Robert Downey Jr. was nominated for the Tropic Thunder for his character in that, which is surprisingly right. But that the comedic role that he was nominated. So they're nominated the same year and they're on 2020, I think it was, or Barbara Walters or some shit like that. And they're sitting at a round table with Anne Hathaway, who was in, you know, nominated that year in Best Supporting and Act Lead. And then Brad Pitt, you know, they ask who Robert Downey Jr., what's your favorite role that you look back on your older roles? And Robert Downey Jr. goes, and then before he could say anything, Brad Pitt goes, Weird Science or something like that. And then, mind you, these are the guy, this is the, when Brad Pitt was an extra, he introduced me to Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah.
And Brad Pitt goes, or Robert Downey Jr. goes to Brad Pitt because he's quick, right? He goes, oh, are we coloring outside the lines now? Are you gonna do that? And I'm thinking, are you going to mention the fact that he was an extra when you were like a big time star in Lesson Zero? And I'm thinking, you know, this happens. It's all the time. You know, somebody's career is up, some career is down. I was the big star 10 years ago. Now I'm the bigger star than you. And then there's people that are great, that are big stars, that all of a sudden their career is gone. And you're like, wait, what happened to that guy? And it's a tough business.
Oh yeah. No, because like, this is the thing, like, okay, let's just say, depending what, when you're the flavor of the month, you are the flavor of the month and there's nothing what can stop you. And like, yeah, everything just seems like, yeah, not going to stop. It's always going to be on that ascent. But when life and reality sort of kicks in and goes, hey, you remember how, like, you remember when you were getting that little bit of an ego about yourself when you like thinking of that Ben sliced bread? Well, we're taking you back down. And it's like going, yeah. And I sometimes worry about people who like go, yeah, I will stomp on your throat getting up there. And when they come back down, it's like, okay, I got to be humble now. It's like, no, you like on the ascent, be a cool person. Because the descent will come. It's just a case of if you can outlast that sort of realm of time. And when I say that, just shifting on to the next level.
Right. They say in Hollywood, you can't hold grudges. And especially in that kind of industry, you can't, because it's just so rampant. Sometimes people will, you know, forget that you are alive or don't treat you like, it's like, oh, you don't get a return call. It's like, really? It's like, you're ghosting me right now. We're a normal friend would never ghost me for a simple phone call. And that just happens. It's not the, there's nothing wrong with when you enter the city that the air creates, it's the culture and you know, what permeates out of that sometimes and the choice that human nature, you know, we predispose towards making bad choices under those circumstances, unless we got our head screwed on straight.
Yeah, no, I hear that. And like, this is the thing, like with doing that, I can imagine going into the rave scene must be a powerful antidote to the realms of like Hollywood, because look, well, this is where you got to be careful about when you're talking about rave music or house music. Okay. Now, people in the UK go, we started it first. Then like you go, right. Then you go, okay. People in Germany go, no, we started it first. And then like, I'm sorry to say this to you. Like as America, it's like, going, you guys got there late to the party. Yeah.
All that's true. The creators of house music was Stephen Silk Hurley, who did a club called House, and Jamie Principle had the first song called Your Love that was created house music, but it was never big in the United States. Then England did love the music and they created raves. They created the whole events around it. I don't think it was Germany. I think Rotterdam, all that came just a little bit after England. And then the United States is like, once the English start doing like the Beatles, they're like, oh, that's pretty cool. You know, that yeah, we'll use that now. So definitely that's kind of like true. The raves started, from what I understand and all the history that I recorded in my documentary and everything else, started in England and in all Great Britain. And, but the music was just poetically, the music, and I love the poeticism of this, was the same thing as jazz, you know. African-Americans created house music same way that popularized jazz and rock and roll with Chuck Berry and Little Richard. And then, you know, the rest of, you know, America, you know, likes it. It becomes big over in England. It becomes big back over here. But from what I understand, that's the wonderful history about how I wasn't really into house music. I was I was more of a hip hop funk guy, but I wanted to be a filmmaker. And I saw the rave thing happening and I'm like, well, I'm a capitalistic scumbag. This will be a good segue. So I did that. And then they could kind of see me, you know, I wouldn't dress up like a raver. You know, I was, you know, more of like a director kind of guy. When I did the tour, I did a tour of raves around America while I filmed the documentary. But that's the history that I know of that. And a lot of MDMA doctors we interviewed because that was a big thing. But and then in the 90s, it was really interesting because Timothy Leary, who was a part of the hippie movement, got involved in raves out in America also. Mm. And he was a big 60s guy. But we don't talk about, when people talk about house music, they don't talk about Stephen Silk Hurley and Jamie Principal, that poetic history behind the man that created the first song, which was it's Jamie Principal who created that song, Your Love, among other people. But there was really, they talk about him the most, and how it was a combination of Depeche Mode and church music when he would go to church. And then playing that song at Stephen Silk Hurley's nightclub, The House. And people loved that music that he would play at The House. They would go to other clubs and go in Chicago and say, can you play the house music? Play music that they play at The House. And they call it house music. And that's how house music got its name.
Mm, yeah, like this is a vein. Put it this way. If you were in the UK, like I was still in school. If you were in the UK around about, I'm going to say 1986, 87. Now, yeah, that's when they were still doing like the legal raves, but they were cracking down. Basically, by 1989, 1990, they basically had it all locked down. And then, like, strangely enough, a little island called Ibiza became very popular all of a sudden. Because, they just were like, yeah, nope, don't do it. Can't be here. Stop it.
And that's pretty much what I heard, too. I heard that, house music created like 85, around there, mid-80s. And then, but there was no raves in America. It happened in England. And then there might be some, well, I remember going to a rave in 88 or 89. You know, it really started, real raves in America started like 89. Mm-hmm. I really don't remember any big raves, like true big ones, like Great Britain had.
Yeah.
Until late 80s.
Yep. So dare I ask, while you were filming at these raves, like, did you maybe partake in anything like a dalliance on the more ravey side of things?
No, yeah, I was always like a neurotic Jew that was afraid to like do any kind of like medication of any kind. You know, I'm almost like a health nut, being that kid that, you know, worked out since I was like 11, you know, yeah. And I was a health conscious guy. I was trying to find pho, like Vietnamese restaurants, so I could eat pho and stay healthy. No, I never really did any of that. I would walk over a lot of bodies that passed out from nitrous. There was a lot of people trying to give me hugs from MDM, from ecstasy. And I've seen through nightclubs, though, I've seen all kinds of stuff. I've been to art installations in LA where I've seen like an artist show. I've seen, this is the craziest thing I've ever seen in a nightclub show. Somebody swallowing eggs naked and then posing like in a Tai Chi kind of like live show. And then crapping the egg as he's laying the egg. Now, if you really try to, so that's impossible. It's like, actually, I don't think it is. I think you swallow the egg, raw egg whole. And then, you know, when egg has equal pressure, it doesn't break. So then you're freaking out. But I saw that. I was like, this is the record books. I'm so glad I'm here, because I will be able to say that is the most insane thing I've ever seen. And I've seen a lot of crazy shit at nightclubs.
So swallow the egg whole.
Yeah.
And then pass the egg whole.
The fact that he was naked in front of like 400 people in an art show in Beverly Hills, like, was like freaking me out. I was like, I'd never believe. But the fact that he was, I saw these cracked eggs and I was like, that's really happening. I mean, that he would do the Tai Chi move and he'd swallow the egg. And then would like, he'd be doing the dance, like the slow, weird interpretive dance. And then you come back and you're like, the guy just laid an egg. And I was like, that's insane. That's a record book kind of like weirdness to me.
That's the truth.
Only in LA.
Only in LA.
Probably happening right now out there.
Of all the, you know what? That is like, that is a hell of a bucket list thing to see. Just like, yeah, I saw a guy swallow a whole egg. Yep. And then lay it like a chicken.
Yeah. I wish that would, you know, I've done gambling parties in LA. You know, when I came back after doing my night, my rave documentary, I went back to LA after that long tour. And I said, you know, gambling in at this time was like the big thing. So I decided to do underground gambling parties in hotel suites. This is before like the movie Molly's Game and all and Rounders and all that. And I've seen some crazy things at gambling parties. And I wrote a screenplay on it, and that's what almost got me a movie deal. But I have yet to see anything crazy as a guy swallowing a raw egg and then laying it.
Yeah, like this is a thing, man. Okay, you've gone through some interesting chapters in your life. Let's just say it's like
Well, it started with my dad because my dad made all that money. He was a multimillionaire and then he lost it all. He was homeless again. And the way he lost it is that he made all this money and he had orgy parties in LA. Where they're like notorious for like these crazy parties. And this is how like in Boogie Nights, like the Burt Reynolds character, loosely characters based on my dad, he would have these photo albums. I showed Paul loved my dad. My dad and him would talk all the time and have fun. And I showed Paul my dad's photo albums, which are sheer carnality of the worst degree you can imagine of these parties. And that's, and the way my dad had this green house and a green Cadillac and green artwork on the wall, kind of like the character in Boogie Nights, that lady that made all the art. And I grew up around this atmosphere when my dad divorced my mom and I'd go to a big house, this greenhouse and Topanga Canyon in LA. And I'd say, was something happening here last night? Because even as a kid, you could realize that there was energy. And I just grew up around a lot of weird things. So nothing really fazed me. Although I was straight laced because I saw a lot of craziness, nothing fazed me as I got older because I've seen it all and been around a lot of car accidents being the youngest and seeing a lot of crazy things happen, you know, as I grew up.
Because like, this is the thing, like I would have thought, okay, with the way you're describing some of the stuff you've gone through in your life, and look, like this is the thing, we haven't sort of deep dived really or anything like this. Like, for what you're like saying about how your dad lived and everything like this, there's one or two ways this could either go. You either like go, no, I've seen what the freak is that. Nope, that is not for me. And away. I go, I'm staying away from that. No. Like Jesus is love, purity. That's the right way, purity. Or you could be like, that's normal. Here is like, dad, right, save a spot for me. But it kind of feels like you've gone like you found a slightly third way of doing it.
Yeah. So my mom was straight laced. She was a tough New York, you know, gal also, but she was the juxtaposition between my dad. She's like, you know, and my dad, well, like my oldest brother was straight laced like me, 14 years older than me.
Yeah.
I was a ploy. I wasn't an oops. I was or whatever, but you know, my mom was trying to keep my dad. Long story there, but my other older brother is 10 years older. He dabbled in that world. I mean, he's at one of those parties at the greenhouse. He'd walk in with an 8-ball and two girls from Minnesota, and they didn't walk out of that room for 2 days, and there'd be some crazy shit. Me, I went the other direction, but you know, my dad still tried to my dad brought a prostitute to my bar mitzvah, probably as an offering. And, or if I wasn't ready yet, then he would fall back on something later on that night, something like that, you know? And then, you know, Even those photo albums, there was nothing wrong with this to his world. Like one time, you know, he got married later on in life, you know, to another woman, and he goes, "Look, man, she wants to throw my photo albums out. I want you to carry it. You know, hold on to this. I already got kids at this point." I said, "What the hell am I going to do with this? What am I going to be the Smithsonian Institute of your porn? I'm not going to hold it. I'm going to show this to my girls one day, and that's grandpa." He goes, "Look, man, just hold on to it." So I look at these old albums, you know, to, you know, old time's sake, and yeah. He's got these orgy pictures next to my bar mitzvah pictures, next to like my graduating pictures, next to my homecoming. I'm like, "What the hell, Dad? What is this?" He goes, "Well, it's just memories of my life." I said, "I understand that, but you have no continuity, you know." So I'm just, I was used to that craziness, and I'd always be around weird people, my dad's side of the world. But I did learn from my mom and an old Russian Jewish lady that would, you know, be very blunt with me about not to do those things. Mm. And being the youngest, I saw my older brother go through, you know, all kinds of drugs, drug addiction and craziness as well. My oldest brother was like my father when my dad wasn't around, because he's a Rolling Stone. And then my sister was like, she's a child psychologist. So I saw all these things around me, and I had stepdad who was a sergeant in the Marine Corps. So I got all this weird stuff going around. So being the youngest, you get a lot of, you know, and growing up with an old lady, you know, my grandmother in the same room, you know, just get, it's a hodgepodge of hopefully I didn't end up screwed up, other than the neuroses that you hear from me right now.
Okay. Yeah. I love it. It's like, I think I've got this in my mind.
Like, well, this is normal for people that grew up in LA. No, I'm joking around. People in LA are like, "That's the fucked up shit, like, man."
It's like, you can't live in LA without at least having a life, which is a screenplay of some bizarre craziness, madness. Like, yeah, extraordinary. It's like, hey, fantastical. Look, because, wow, I can understand this now. Because, okay, age difference between you and your oldest brother, like, he's lived a life where, like, he's like there for the God grace of God go I, like, yeah, basically having a like straight-laced mother who's like and then having like a grandmother which is like, "Look, I escaped Russia concentration camps, look, I did everything in my power to get to the United States to live a better life, don't fuck it up." As I go, and then having a sister which studies psychology, like, good God, no, I would not want to piss off your sister. I would, like, if I was in your position, I'd be like, going, "Hey," it's like, going, "Wait, did she just play some psychological mind game with me?"
Well, I grew up with three strong Jewish ladies, my grandmother, my mom, and my sister. And you're telling, the women are the boss in that family. So, you know, they were really strong minded. And I grew up with a lot of, you know, figures, a lot of, you know, authoritative figures. You know, but, you know, I got to tell you, you know, it was interesting because I saw so much pain towards my dad's lifestyle. You know, his family was really screwed up. They put him in an orphanage when he was 8 years old. He had to run away from the orphanage, so he was homeless. You know, his younger brother was abused. His dad and his younger brother end up living with him after my dad fought his way back to get a condo out of his van, you know, after he was a millionaire in the late 80s. They're living with him. And then his brother, who just got out of the hospital, he was gay, had a relapse because when he was, you know, it was tough to be a gay person in the 80s. Wow. It wasn't easy as it is now. And then my dad was at his girlfriend's house, and my dad's brother was just depressed, and he shot and killed himself, and he died in my dad's arms, and he ran in the room, and he shot himself with a shotgun. And, you know, you hear these things and all this is, you start to realize, and there's more tragedy, but you just hear all these things and how all the unhappiness, it's like watching Goodfellas, but it's your life. And you're like, I don't want that to be me. I mean, I just could see that this shit is not going to be for me. You know, my whole light childhood was like looking out the window. My dad would show up. He'd be there for 2 weeks, you know, and be gone. You know, or say, "Hey, I'll be home at 8. And he'd show up in April. Yeah. So I didn't want to be, that's why I could have been a starving actor and a filmmaker and like sleep outside a Joe Papp Theater in New York and try to be like, you know, that guy. But I also wanted to have a family. So I said, I'm going to do my business route. And because that's a priority of mine as well. So all this had to do with, I guess, what we're talking about, you know, long shot leaders and, you know, someone's history and why I do what I do and why I chose one thing. Hopefully I'm glad I wasn't born like the second oldest, because maybe I would have got involved in the same kind of lifestyle like my brother.
Possibly, because like this is the thing, like, okay, listen to that, you're like, oh wow. But like, when, like, it's another thing when you sort of witness, like, if you're living in a household where money's lost, and I'm saying this purely from a hypothetical, it's a case of you kind of like look at it and go, yeah, had everything, nothing was a struggle, and then all of a sudden it's gone. It's not there forever. It's not there to make, like, it was easier, and now it's so much now more harder. Like, to sort of like go, okay, living in those sort of two worlds, and but still being in the same area where, like, yeah, you could look at your sort of peers, like, or even look down on them sometimes economically, to like going, yeah, my life is not the same, and they're like, I don't think you can actually ever sort of relate to what we're going through at this
rate. It goes back to the Mike Tyson line. I love Mike Tyson, by the way. It goes back to Tyson's line where he said to take disadvantages and make them advantages. You know, being I think it was great to see a lot of wealth. When I was a kid, my dad, I got drove around when I, until I was 6 years old, we would drive around a limousine, you know, and had drivers and stuff. And then by the time I was, I don't know, 8 or 9, everything was lost. He just, you know, went through with this crazy lifestyle. But my mom held on to this home in Encino, which was like the one asset, you know, and we had to stay there, but we got to live around rich people. But we had nothing. We were like the Encino Jubilees. We were like the hillbillies of the area, you know? And, but you see around a lot of, when you have nothing and everybody else around you has a lot, it's a gift, because you grow up hungry and you're like, I want what they have. And they're just like, you know, they're lazy. I mean, a lot of rich people get lazy. Kids are rich people get lazy. And when you don't have anything, then you're seeing what they got. You grow up hungry. So that was a gift, I think, you know, and I think that you take a lot of disadvantages and you give them your own story, because we could believe bullshit, or we could believe, you know, something that either way, you know, so might as well believe empowering beliefs that are going to put you in empowering position as opposed to a disempowering belief. Yeah, it's just our choice.
Yeah, no, because like this is the thing. It's an interesting thing what you say about the many rich like people, like, yeah. They get lazy. But I'd say it's one of the things where, especially if it's not the generation which is fought to make that wealth.
Well, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
Yeah. The children of people, you know, not always, but like I see it a lot.
Yeah. It's a case of, yeah, growing up in like relative comfort all the time. It's one of those things which I would say it's comfort is good to a point. You can't have too much comfort and you can't have too much discomfort. I would say to grow, to see where you can be the best person you can be, you need that element of discomfort on a regular basis. And look, for yourself, like I'm talking from purely a hypothetical. I have not lived a millionaire lifestyle. Like, let me see, I have put credit on, but still, that's another story. It's like, live that millionaire lifestyle. Oh, pay off a number of years. Debt, no. But to see it, like to have that comfort and have it taken away, like, ouch. That's a little bit more, and especially in a formative time from 6 to 8, like 6 to 9, excuse me. For yourself, that is a very formative time. But with this, I would say more people in this world, if they want to know who they are, want to know where they want to go, like challenging themselves, going to those places of discomfort is the place to be. Because if they don't do that, they'll never know. They will never know who they are. They will never know how great they could possibly be. And I'm not talking about, this person's a world leader. It might be just simple things. That person's a great friend. Or like it might be a next level up. That person's a great family person. It's like, it doesn't have to be like something epic. It's just a case of really challenge yourself. See where you can go. See how far you can fly, you know?
Absolutely. No, I was thinking about this aphorism or this saying about trees. Was it the windy tree is the one that grows the strongest? The tree in a windy area is the one that grows the strongest because it has adversity. Iron sharpens iron. You know, all those aphorisms are true because, you know, that's what helps you to grow.
Yeah. So like this is the thing, look, I it would be a miss for me not to talk about Dirk Dekeler, because look, it's like, look, this is the thing. Dirk Dekeler, my God, how on earth did you manage to get into that project?
Paul Anderson, Paul Thomas Anderson, he was dating my girlfriend's sister. I drove him home one night. I had him rolling for about, 40 minutes on the way home. And 2 days later, he calls me up, says he was an inspiring filmmaker. He's like, I want to do a short film about the rise and fall of a porno star named Dirk Dekeler. And I want you to play Dirk Dekeler. I said, I'm in. So then we went to his house, had a production meeting, in his bedroom at his parents' house, Oh, yeah, and then,
okay. That must have been a weird meeting. So, hey, so
he wants to
Michael.
Be
Michael. He's coming around. He's going to be a porn star.
Right. Well, it was, the Dirk Dekeler story is more of like Spinal Tap version back then, that it was, it wasn't like Boogie Nights, but it was like, the rise and fall of a porn star, like meets Spinal Tap documentary style. And then, about 5 months later, we did some other fun little video projects. And then 5 months later, we shot it, over a course of maybe several weeks, in different locations, off and on. And then he did well with it. He got American Film Institute Award, for video. And, back then that was a category because video was the thing. And then it was interesting to see, how someone that wasn't successful became successful, before my eyes, because I never really saw that happen that way. So when he started making more films and, it's kind of like Richard Pryor's joke when he was boxing, and then he throws a jab. It's like, oh, this shit really works, yeah. And then you get kind of good with it, and then throw another jab, bang, sometimes you get too cocky. You throw one of those out there too long and you get knocked out. But to see the success that he had, how I did, that's what kind of encouraged me to go for, more success and see other people that say this can really work. Because my belief was I never seen anybody start from nothing and create something. Paul came from a wealthy family, but he wasn't handed anything to him. He earned the filmmaking and he knew what he wanted to do at a young age. He knew that he wanted to be a filmmaker at 6 years old. His school project was write what you want to do when you grow up. And his school project, he wrote, I want to be a writer, director, filmmaker, special effects man. I know how to do everything. I can do everything. And that was 6 years old. Now, he didn't become a special effects man, but he did everything else. And to know what you want to do and to see somebody like that. So that was a wonderful thing for me to kind of witness that, it's kind of like, helped me along the way to see like, it doesn't matter. Everybody's got a chance to do what they want to do. Everybody's got a chance to, there's only 24 hours a day. Everybody's got the same 24 hours.
Absolutely. And you know what? I do love that story because like the reason why I love that, because this is the thing. We always see the end product. Anyone you see out there who's big up there, it's like, yes, this person was a star overnight. It's like, right. And you're like, you don't see the hours, the whole process, the pain, the sweat, the tears, the joyful moments, the triumphs, the victories, leading them up to that point.
I'll even expand on that a little bit. If you got anybody out there listening has a son or daughter that shows a spark in something, and you think, well, I want them to be a dentist or whatever. Nothing wrong with that. But if they, because he knew what he wanted to do at a young age. And that's a beautiful thing. And he was so certain of it. When you're that hyper-focused on something in the beginning, it's not that you get like the knowledge from 6 years old to, 18 years old or 19. No, it's exponentially because those are the formative years of your life. So that kind of, compounded with the time plus the effort, plus the informative years, the forming years, I mean, that's just, I see so many successful people now that know what they want to do at a young age when they want it that young. It's just so encourage that route if that's what they truly want, because they'll turn it into something amazing.
Absolutely. Yeah. As I was going to say, with regards to that, like when you see the end product, you go, right, star overnight. But now with our 21st century lifestyle, we can actually see the sort of journey for some of these people. But like with that journey, you kind of still getting the edited highlights of it all. You're not getting sometimes the trueness of it. But when you can see it, like, yeah, one-to-one, like firsthand, you get very much a very unique perspective of it. It's obtainable, like for people. You can like, oh, right, I can see what this they've done. And yeah, these are the steps I need to take. Wow.
Seeing the wins and the failures too. Seeing the failures and going, hey, they could fail. They failed just like me, or they're not perfect. Mm. That kind of makes me feel better because I felt like I had to do that right in order to make something happen well, to do it right. Make you do something. I could do something wrong. It does not, doesn't mean I can't do something right, you know, and those help as well.
Yeah, no, because like this is the thing. Got to remember, perfection is an illusion. It doesn't exist.
Right. Agree. That's good. Yes.
Yeah. And like when people would sort of push to just, I need it to be perfect. I need that perfect moment to be there before I can start this, before I can do that, before I get my sort of dream of success. All it is when you push for perfection, all you're doing is empowering procrastination, holding off whatever thing you want to do in your life to move you onto that next level. Maybe it's like a little bit of residual fear in your mind. Maybe it's a little bit of doubt what lives within. Maybe it's a case of, yeah, it's like some bullshit you've been saying, but you're not actually wanting to do it. And yeah, waiting for that perfect moment is the thing which, oh, it wasn't the right moment, so I couldn't start. Get up, do, rather than sort of wait around because right. Someone else will, you know?
That's right. That's right. I love what you're singing.
I can't say it's some things I've observed. I can't say this is like, yeah, the gospel, and anyone who like goes, oh no, that might be toxic and everything like this. I'm like, oh, look, look at some people out there who have been successful, who are doing it. People you look to and like look up to and go, that person, I want to be that. Yeah, most, like I would say the vast majority of them have not had that perfect moment to like have like start whatever endeavor they might have been in. They're not that sort of perfect being, and they have made tons of mistakes and failed more times than you can actually count. You know, so that's what I've observed, and people can disagree with me. I'm welcome it. I welcome discussion, you know.
I like that discussion. I like everything because that's, you know, it starts with, you know, one key component of the lifeblood of the engine is gratitude, you know, and if you don't have gratitude, but then also, you know, learning to fail. So when you do fail, you end up saying, well, what can I learn from this? What's great about this? If there was something great about it, what it would be, which is like a neurolinguistic programming, you know, question to ask, you know, I got really heavily involved in personal development when I was in my early 20s, go figure, you know, because of all the crap that, you know, you want to try to be, you know, understand why people do what they do. So I like Tony Robbins. I've been through every single seminar he's done. I've been to his resort in Mali and you want to try to understand things. And I think that from a personal development standpoint, what you rattled off, you know, is embracing, not owning failure and not trying to be, you know, like romanticize failure, but own it, learn from it, be okay with it, and then, you know, grab onto your successes and just be okay with, you know, putting yourself out there. And it's okay to, you know, try to fail, try to look embarrassed or whatever, because you're going to learn something from that. As long as everything comes from a place of a kind heart, you know, you're going to be fine.
Yeah, no, I agree. And like, this is the thing, I would say one of those things, like, yeah, don't get caught up with the whole realm of failure, because like people today sort of demonize failure. It's like, you failed, like you must suck now. It's like, you're like, oh, right. And when you say, yeah, failure is an opportunity to learn. It's a case of, yeah.
And I think a lot of people are getting towards that level saying, yeah, we all know that failure is good, but here's the difference between intellectual knowledge and physical knowledge. Mm-hmm. Say, look, you know, once you start to realize, you know, and you put yourself out there and it's okay to fail, then you say, well, what does that look like for me on a day-to-day basis when I'm ever at an impasse and somebody says, hey, you got it. You want to perform here on this date, or do you want to be able to go commit to this situation that you know you should do, but you hold back. It's the decision making where you just force yourself to be in situations that you know you're afraid to fail or possibly fail, but you know that you're really it's on your list. It's one of your top. It coincides with your top goals. I think putting yourself out there you know, and saying, yeah, I understand. We all know that failure, you know, not, but putting yourself out there to deal with it, applying it physically is the next step.
I hear that. Now, this is another interesting thing about you. Look, many people in this world today, and like you'll hear them go, no, follow your passions. Follow the things what like, yeah, inspire you. And like, yes, you'll never work a day in your life. Ah, it's wonderful. Like, you were following your passions. You were in the whole sort of like game of films. Look, you knew people. You were building that network. And yet you went, hey, you know what? Let's go down the practical route. Like, okay, I'm going to start my own business. And when I say practical, look, when starting a business is not the easiest thing to do. Anyone who thinks it's easy is a fool, idiot, no idea, clueless. But yeah. What inspired you to like go, yeah? I know you mentioned this earlier and briefly, but yeah.
Well, when after 2 years of that development hell, you know, I met with everybody. I met with Joel Silver's office. I met with so many, you know, I had this deal at Trimark Pictures. They were going to make my gambling movie and that fell through. Robin Shore was the president of the Trimark Pictures. She went on, moved on. And I was just like, you know, I can't handle this. I'm not going to, you know, I have other goals for my life. So I want to be able to do a movie, but I don't have any money. So I'm just going to create another business. Like I was a nightclub promoter, I'll create another business. And I knew I wanted to do something on the internet. So I decided to do that business. And I said, well, this is gonna be my film business and I'll be able to segue into film. But then something happens and you're like, you know what? I always want to be an entrepreneur. And I always wanted to be an entrepreneur before I wanted to be a filmmaker or an actor.
Yeah.
But still it was my dream to be a filmmaker and an actor. So after that, you know, that I did that film, which is crazy because I was running a business out of my rented $800 a month shack in Sherman Oaks. And I was running the business out of there. It was my production company for my film. It was crazy and almost bottomed out my business. I decided I'm going to choose maybe an opportunity over this passion, which is this lifelong passion of wanting to be a stand-up comedian, an actor, filmmaker, you know. And I'm going to nurture this business. So I grew it to a business that has made over $100 million since. And it's continuing to grow. And I have other big plans for it. Hopefully it'll kind of grow even much bigger. We have plans for next year. But I always knew that, like, you know, I want to be able to have a family. But one day, just like that's happening now, as we're talking, I saw my daughter drive down the driveway with some friends. She's 15 and a half. And another one's going to be 13 soon. They get older and they're like, you know what, Dad? I don't have to be with you all the time. I got plans with my friends. And that's why I kind of started a podcast 6 months ago. Cause I'm like, okay, I got some time freed up. I get, you know, the life shifts. And now the more money you make, you know, in business, now there's rules that Hollywood or people have in their heads to say, well, you got to do that when you're younger or, you know, your time's past. It's like bullshit. I'm just going to keep on doing what I'm doing. I don't care about rules or anything anymore. I'm going to do my business. I'm going to make money. My priorities is to be with my children. But now when things loosen up, I have more time and I maybe can do a film project again, or I can start doing stand-up comedy again, along with, you know, my priority is my business because that's what grows and makes a lot of money for me. Didn't able to do some of those projects and take chances on expensive side gigs, you know, but that's the way I philosophize those things. You know, I that's the route I'm going to take. That's the journey I'm on right now. So, you know, that's why I did this business is because I actually initially did it to make a movie. But now, you know, I always wanted to be like my dad was known as the calculator kid. You know, he sold those calculators, you know, when I was getting, I said, I want to be the calculator kid because he sold so many of these damn calculators when he made all those millions before he lost it. They called him the calculator kid. This is when the calculators were like a big item in the 70s, you know, when they got small. Yeah. And then when I started my business, and you're going to laugh when I tell you what I chose to sell in 2000 to make money for that film was tarpaulins. And I sold them because it was like an outdoor product. It was, you know, I could help the homeless. I could help people in tragedy and all that. I said, that'll be an interesting item. And I want to be able to do something niche on the internet, among other reasons that we won't get into why I chose that product. And then after there was these hurricanes in Florida and Hurricane Katrina and all that, and I bought up the country and I became the number one person in this industry. the next year, like my fourth year in business, they started calling me, because I bought out the whole United States of a supply, making sales on these things before I started importing everything. And they said, "You're Hurricane Mike." And I was like, "That's stupid." I said, I was like, "Happy Gilmore. Can't we put like a hockey guy on top of the golf guy? I don't want to be, I want to be able to filmmaker. I don't want to be Hurricane Mike." But I said, "Mike, your initial goal in the beginning was to be like the calculator kid." I said, "Maybe you could be Hurricane Mike. It doesn't matter. Who cares what you're called or who says what, or it matters what your path is, what you're going to do." And that's kind of like my story about how, like, the business I do now I take it with ownership. We're actually, I've seen other companies that have become really cool. I don't know if you guys have Yeti out there, and they make coolers, Yeti coolers.
Like, this is the thing. Yeti is, it's one of those brands which I watch a lot of sort of internet stuff. So I know of Yeti. And right. Like, it's kind of, I can get Yeti stuff over here via Amazon, but it's not like, it's everywhere. If you get what
it's I mean. Huge out here. It's a multi-billion dollar company. It's publicly traded now. And they started 6 years after me in 2006 with selling coolers. And I said, wait a second. I said, I used to think that selling tarps is stupid, you know, and I was kind of just, it wasn't stupid, but it was like more, you know, not as cool as like people like, you know, I was like, wait a second. We started designing a product last year. It's coming out next year. And I said, why can't we define, you know, something in the outdoor sect, you know, camping, fishing, hunting kind of thing, to where we can make this an adventurous product the same way that Yeti made the cooler? Because it's a whole lifestyle brand, you know? And so I thought, you know what? I'm tired. You know, you get to a certain age and you get your personal development catches up with maturity and you're like, it doesn't matter how old you are, doesn't matter what you do, doesn't matter, because I used to make fun of my last name. Like, Michael Stein can't be an actor's name. Pacino, De Niro, those are actors' names. It's ridiculous. Then Schwarzenegger becomes huge after, so that negates my idea. I was like, I can't be a good businessman because I'm only 5'7", you know, but because of all, it's read all these articles, the tall people are, you know, successful. Well, Jeff Bezos is the richest man in the world. He's 5'7". He's the same height as me. So you're going to believe some bullshit. Might as well believe some bullshit that leads you in the right direction, because none of it matters. And so it doesn't matter if I'm going to start my film career, you know, in a couple of years from now, you know, after my kids are grown up and I want to do that. It doesn't matter if I do stand-up comedy when I'm old fart. It doesn't matter if I'm an entrepreneur, stand-up comedian, filmmaker. It doesn't matter. I was like, what are you trying to do now? It's like, I'm doing whatever damn I want to do. And as long as you own that, then you say, well, that seems natural because his last name Schwarzenegger, it's the same shit.
Yeah, no, because when I was doing my research and I saw tarps come up, I was like, wait, did I put something in wrong? But I was like, okay, no, right. Yeah. Because like, this is the thing, like, today it's sexy tech. If it's not tech, it's got to be sexy. And like, when you bring up Yeti and what you're doing yourself with tarps, people forget that, yeah, more times than not, like, depending where you are, you're going to either need a cooler or, like, yeah, you're going to, like, definitely in America, you're going to need a tarp on a regular basis.
Yeah, if you're into camping or hiking or, but it, right now it sounds silly, but we're doing something that is not, is somewhat related to that. I can't talk about it, but it's going to be mind blowing, you know, for the kind of product it is. But it's something that turns into a tarp, but it's also something else. And it's very unique, but it's like, it sounds silly now, but it's silly until someone makes it like a household thing. And then it's not silly anymore. And it's just like, you know, it's silly. I mean, I grew up with contrast. I grew up with my dad putting orgy pictures next to my prom pictures. You know, I wouldn't do that. But if that seems okay to some people in the world, then I'm sure that people can accept the fact that I'm an entrepreneur and, like, I can go on stage and do stand-up comedy, or I can make a film, you know, and people aren't going to judge me for it, as long as the product's good and you're having fun and you don't, like, pay heed to it.
Yeah, like, I can just only picture in my mind. It's like, I'm so proud of your son. Look at you there in your prom uniform. It's like, dad, thank you for putting up the picture, like, trying to place and everything like this. But I don't think anyone's going to see it because the freeway, which is going on the left.
You know, my wife found those photo albums one time. She goes, what the heck is this? Because she thought it was mine. And then she saw some pictures of my dad. She goes, oh, no, I know what this is.
Okay. Just like, hey, no, baby, no. It's not like that.
Just like, right. No, she knew who my dad was. My dad took me when I was, we were in Vegas one time when this is near the latter of his life. And he's like, no, I just want to come by there was the Cheetah Strip Club. He takes me and my friend. I was like, Dad, I'm not going inside there. I hate these places. I grew up with you trying to get me to go in these places. I'm not going to do it. I walked in there for 2 seconds. I walk out. I call my wife. It's like our first year married. I said, my dad drive me to a strip club. I don't want to be here. She's like, and then he walks out and he goes, hey, it's Miriam. I'm like, yeah. He grabs the phone and he goes, hey, Miriam, how are you doing? She goes, what are you doing, Larry? He goes, oh, we're at the deli just having some sandwiches out in front of the parking lot. She goes, don't lie to me, Larry. Michael just told me you're at a strip club. He's like, hey, Miriam, how you doing? He was like Santa Claus. He was like a cross between Santa Claus and Elvis. And it was hard to get mad at the guy as much as that he would try to run one over on you.
Oh, damn. That's mental. That is mental. Now, I have to say, we have a guest in common for podcasting. Brendan from Master Talk.
Brendan, public speaker?
Yes.
Yeah. Kamisari?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I was
he's a great guy.
Yeah, he's a great chap. I've got to say, very nice talking to him. I was like, oh, was that Brendan? Yeah. I was like, it brought a smile to my face.
I love that guy. That guy takes the best pictures in the world. You see him? He's like public speaker /GQ guy.
Well, yes. Like, put it this way, I think if you poured him into a suit and then he'll just like simply just do it and look like,
he likes to pose. It's like,
yeah,
he's like a good looking kid though. Yeah,
yeah, just like instant pose. But like, yeah. But your podcast, I've got to say, you have had some prominent guests. I've got to say, the one what really stands out for me, because I love his book, Robert Greene, 48 Laws of Power. That must have been like, that must have been a heavy conversation, I've got to say.
I didn't know. He's a Jewish boy from LA, like me. I'm a Jewish boy from the Valley, with the LA and the Valley are like, 10 minutes away from each other. He's a really interesting character. He wrote that book for the same reason I made Love Hollywood Style, which is like an anti-Hollywood film. He wrote the book 48 Laws of Power because he was like under the thumb of so many powerful people in Hollywood. And he was the one that got treated poorly, like what power can be done. There's good ways to do the laws of power and there's negative ways of the laws of power. And he talks about both of them, but and he's also a scholar. He's been a scholar his whole life. Really interesting guy.
Yeah, no, because like this is a whole thing. You like if you listen to the 48 Laws of Power, the powers of war, all of like basically you just get so many sort of snippets from like Aesop's fables. What is it, the Five Rings? Like you get all of this sort of like snippets here, there, and everywhere, and how it applies to history and everything like this. And you're like, oh my lord. You're like, oh, it's so clear. It's like, right. I got to say, yeah, love that guest. But like with your podcast, like how many people have you had on now? How long has it been going for now?
Today, I think episode 124 came out, but I do 3 episodes a week. And we started it in March this year. And I just, sometimes I'll do some bonus, but I just do like today's Friday. I'm talking to you and I do all of my episodes on Fridays. So I do maybe one on a Thursday night and one on a Saturday or Sunday, but mainly on Fridays and I batch them. So it's not really like I'm doing this all week long. And then I have virtual assistants that help me edit it and put it together and all my promotionals. So I try to leverage and I put processes in place so I could do it, but we've done 124 as of today, Friday. The 124th episode came out. So it's been about, 8 months, 9 months that we've been doing it.
Oh, good God. Not respect to you because this is the thing. No, got to say it. Like I was doing one episode a week and I was like, okay, yeah, ticking along. And it was like going, I was again, very ahead of myself. I was like, okay, let me do 2 episodes a week. But like the only factor what works against me at this present time, 9 to 5, everything like that. Time,
right.
And like, yeah, if I could afford to do the assistant thing, I'll definitely do that. And like, yeah, right. I most probably look to that doing that in the future because it needs to be clipped up. clip it up. And I don't have like a one-handed fella who is called Jamie. One day.
Right. Exactly. I hear you.
Yeah, but like this is the thing, that many episodes in 8 months' time. Like it's impressive, got to say. And doing a 3 times a week upload, how has that been sort of affecting the sort of number? Well, I don't, not so much numbers, but yeah, getting people's attention, you know?
You know, it's the more, you know, John Lee Dumas, who's been on my show, he does Entrepreneurs on Fire. He's like the number one entrepreneur, you know, a person out there for podcasts, and he does 5 days a week. And I knew that I wanted to do at least 3. I knew I wanted to batch, you know, I'm doing this for networking reasons and connection reasons. And I love people. It's like nightclubs again for me, but I get to meet people like yourself, you know, and enjoy their company. And I'm learning as I go. So, and I just, it doesn't take a lot of time for me because I've worked it into my process. So like right after this, I'll probably have to slip into some business stuff. And then I do have like actually one more interview. I'm interviewing somebody in about 12 minutes from now. So, you know, it's like, I just mind my time. It's okay. We're good. And so I just mind my time, you know, and I, you know, and then I get back to work. And plus work for me is play, you know, designing a new product and marketing and running my business and talking to my employees and doing all that is nothing but play, you know? And that's why, there's levels of feelings. Let's end on this. This will be my personal development. There's levels of feelings. There's things that don't feel good that aren't good for you. There's things that feel good that are good for you. There's things that feel good that are good for you. And, there's things that, don't feel good that aren't good for you, right? There's all four. Anyways, the levels of feelings, like you, there's things that in the beginning that you're doing that might not feel good, but you know, they're good for you, like working out or eating broccoli. But then you train your mind to where they do feel good and they are good for you. And you reframe your situation. And that's what I do with the podcast and my time management, is that there's certain things that, you know, I fit into my schedule that in the past might have been not feel good, but now they feel good because I've trained my mind and I enjoy it.
Fantastic. Now, okay, like it's come to that time of the show, but like, yeah. So with this, with all you've done, through all your life, like this, like crazy movie, TV show series of a life you've had, where yes, you've done extraordinary things and yeah, you've lived a life less than ordinary. What would you say have been some of the, what has been the biggest lesson you've learned?
Time plus effort will enable you to get closer towards probable success and take and be relentless. And also, I'll just tell you what I tell my kids. How's about that? Take care of your body. Take care of your mind. Be a force for good. Be a leader. Be a happy person. And they kind of like, you know, it's like the top three: take care of your body, take care of your mind, and be a happy person. I'm happy every single day. I'm not always operating off of nines and tens, you know, but you know, you learn personal development, learn why you do what you do, why other people do what they do. And, you know, just life is not a hard thing to, you know, trying to succeed and dealing with, you know, crazy things in your life, trying to be successful as an entrepreneur or whatever you're trying to do, whether it's being stand-up comedy or whatever, you know, the process to understand the concept is not difficult. Doing the process and understanding, you know, I could tell you what a strawberry tastes like. Yeah, I get it. It's sweet. And I could feel this. I could almost imagine what the seeds are, you know, the texture's like. But then tasting the strawberry over and over again and different strawberries and then going, okay, I know a lot about strawberries now because I've tasted so many strawberries. Mm. That's the same thing in life. You just need to put yourself out there. So understand, you know, that process and don't, so when you say, somebody told me about a strawberry a million times and then I tasted it and it was just wrong. It's like, I worked out, but it wasn't right. Or I tried the business and it was wrong. It's like, you only tasted it once. You got to work out over and over and over again until you get it right. That's part of my explanation on a lesson as far as that's concerned.
Fantastic. Ah, Michael, I've got to say thank you for coming on today. You, sir, have been an absolute superstar. Yeah.
You know what I'd like to do with you? I'd like to go to a London pub and have a pint with you one day. That's what I'd like to do.
Well, you know what? Look, come over. Trust me. I'll get you rocking and a-jiving. A-proving. Yeah, trust me. We'll have a good time. Yeah, absolutely. Can you tell the lovely people how they can find you out there on these interwebs?
Interwebs. I like that. Just go to longshotleaders.com. If you have a long shot story, it doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be financial or anything, anything where you've overcome large obstacles to find any type of success. Give us a shout out at longshotleaders.com. All my socials up there. You can find me through that. And want to hear about your long shot story.
Outstanding. I'll put all of this into the show notes, into the show description, so you can find him out there. Brilliant. I've enjoyed this. I really have.
I have enjoyed it too. Thank you.
Excellent. And I hope you have enjoyed it too, my friends, my life warriors, who have stuck with us to this point. Please stay safe, stay well, be awesome, be excellent, be fantastic. Be all the positive bees you can be in this world, and then some, guys. Have a great day. Yes. Peace. And we are...